Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Download now at provision.money and use code PREMIER to get your first month free. That's provision.money.
Well, good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half here on the show that gets different points of view together to debate and dialogue some of the big issues of the day. And we're going to be doing that in the company of two people talking about the transgender debate, the Caitlyn Jenner story that has sparked a lot of interest and response over the last few weeks. And just at the very top of the show, I wanted to give a brief disclaimer that for anyone listening this Saturday afternoon, today's show will contain some sensitive subject matter, so please be aware of that if you've any concerns for the age appropriateness of anybody listening. Okay, so with that disclaimer out of the way, I'll be introducing my two guests. Both have had experience of being transgender. One is a current transgender Christian, one an ex-transgender Christian, in just a moment's time. Unbelievable helps you to think through big issues of faith, belief, history, science, philosophy, and much more besides. If you want to listen back to many of the past programmes on the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can subscribe to the podcast there. You can find further resources, loads of videos from previous Unbelievable conferences as well. Also worth noting that you can get in touch with the show if you want to email in. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the way to do that. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. You can also find us online to tell us your thoughts as well via the Facebook page, the Twitter account at UnbelievableJB, or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for either of those. Unbelievable is part of Faith Explored every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio. And to complete the round of shows, you'll be hearing The Profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon as Ben Cantalong talks about his life and faith and his day job as a worship leader for Soul Survivor. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Right now, though, time to get into today's big issue.
You're unbelievable.
Well, recently the story of Caitlyn Jenner went around the world, and Bruce Jenner was a well-known athlete in the USA, also one of the personalities in the Keeping Up with the Kardashians reality TV show. However, he recently underwent a sex change operation, which was revealed in a glamorous photo shoot on the cover of Vanity Fair in June with the title Call Me Caitlyn. Her newly minted Twitter account received over 1 million followers in 5 hours, and it's unleashed a torrent of both positive and negative feedback to the story, including a lot of commentary by Christians, and Jenner professes to be a Christian too. Well, we're going to hear from two different Christians on the issue of transgenderism today. Jenny Ann Bishop is a transgender woman who holds positions in a number of transgender networks and is also trans ministry coordinator at Metropolitan Church Manchester. Walt Heyer lived as a transgender woman under the name Laura Jensen for a number of years before reversing his surgery in order to become a man again, after coming to regret his decision. And part of that process was his Christian conversion too. So he says that in his experience, sex changes fix nothing for people who undergo them. Not the case, says Jenny Ann Bishop, who's my other guest on the programme today. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us on.
And me too. And can I just say one thing? We don't talk about sex change in the UK because you cannot change the body that much. We talk about genital reconstruction surgery.
Okay. No, that's good. That's a good clarification. And Jenner has not actually had the sex change surgery. He still has the boys.
Indeed. And Jenny Ann, perhaps we'll start with you on that front, just to give us a sense of your story. You're a Christian. Tell us about what at what point you decided that you had a transgender experience, you had transgender feelings.
Really, from about 3 or 4 years old, I knew something wasn't quite right because I wanted to be like my sister. And indeed, I borrowed my sister's and my mum's clothes and went to school like that to practice the woman I knew I was going to grow up to be. And of course, that upset people, bearing in mind that was in 1952. So long time ago, and I got sent to the psychiatrist at six, who said, oh, it's just a child experimenting, don't worry about it. But the negative reaction I got from my parents, the school and the church I went to, because I was a Roman Catholic then and I went to a church school, said to me, you have to suppress these feelings. And that was very sad. The next time I explored it was at university, and again I was told, that's not for you, get married, have a family, and it'll all go away. And of course it doesn't, but having got married, I decided I couldn't transition, have surgery or take hormones, because I had family responsibilities. And basically I kept to that until my marriage ended after 31 years, and my kids were all grown up. They're in their mid-40s now. And then I had an experience at the church I went to where really I was amazed that I was just accepted as Jenny Ann, because in my spare time all these years, I'd had reserved time as Jenny Ann. And I just felt that was who I was. And the church absolutely accepted me right from the beginning. And they taught me that far from being trans being a stigma, it actually allowed me to form the character of who I am and to help other people who are trans.
Jenny-Ann, without going into graphic details, as the show's broadcasting obviously at a kind of afternoon time,
sure.
But did you, as it were, have surgery that changed parts of your body to look like a woman?
Yes, I had genital reconstruction surgery, I had voice surgery, and I had facial surgery and breast implants over a few years. And bear in mind too that an awful lot of people who transition in the UK, maybe 70-80%, don't have surgery because they don't feel they need it. I felt I hadn't got the wrong body, it just wasn't equipped in the right way. And I went about re-equipping it to be as close to the person I knew in my head I was. So I agree, you cannot change the absolute sex of the body, or the phenotype as it's called, but you can match your gender identity to how you present yourself. And that's the real key. It's about your identity, not your body.
And you feel yourself more of a whole person. You're happier now, essentially, that you've had the pattern.
Undoubtedly. And I always thought that having the genital reconstruction surgery would be good, and it was another way of my moving on. And it was thinking about practical things like then nobody would ever change me in the ladies, because my body was to all intents and purposes female that way. But when I had it, I got hit by this wall of euphoria, and I went from gender dysphoria to gender euphoria. And 6 years later, I still have that. Every morning I wake up joyous just to be who I am. And I see that in many of my trans friends. I think where things go wrong is where people go through the process too quickly, don't examine their ideas, and don't look to see if there's some comorbidity. In other words, they have some other mental problem that may be affecting the way they feel about their identity. You know, for a lot of trans people like myself, we've spent 40, 50 years thinking about it. So it's not a decision you make lightly.
Well, let's bring in Walt at this point. And Walt, you have a fairly extraordinary story yourself, having, as it were, gone in the direction of becoming a woman for several mm-hmm. years, and then actually reversing that again. So just if you can, I know it's a long story, but if you can give us the brief version, just tell us what happened in your case.
Yeah, I started out at the age of 4 years old, and that was in 1944. And I was cross-dressing and continued to cross-dress. And from the time I was 4 years old, cross-dressing and identifying as a female was normal for me. Although, you know, I stayed in the closet in certain areas of my life because I knew that it wasn't going to be widely accepted. And I grew up, you know, to the ripe old age of early 20s and got married and fostered a couple of children and still had this very, very strong feelings about wanting to become a woman, not just to dress as one, but I actually wanted to become a woman. And so after 17 years of marriage, I went to the guy who wrote the Harry Benjamin International Standards of Care, Dr. Paul Walker, the best in the country, our country at the time in the U.S. And he diagnosed me with gender dysphoria and told me that you know, the best treatment for me would be hormone therapy and surgery. So I went through a two-year period of you know, working through the psychological part of it, being evaluated, and I went back just before the 2 years was up, and went through that again. And he diagnosed me again with gender dysphoria, wrote my approval letter, and I went for surgery in 1983. So I underwent the genital reconstruction surgery and changed my birth record and all the records, and became Laura Jensen after filing for divorce. So I lived successfully as a female and attended church for years as a female. And then I studied psychology and started studying the gender reassignment, the people who are struggling with it, and began to realize that a large number of them, certainly not all of them, struggle with some sort of comorbid disorder or perhaps a fetish or some other issue that that they have a phobia or a disorder or a fetish. So I wanted to study that side of it, and in doing so, I was at church and I was in prayer one time, and the Lord came to me, and I could see him visually reach his arms out to me and said, come with me and be safe with me. And at that time, my life was redeemed and restored, and I returned to my male gender. And I've lived that way now for 20 years. And while there was a tremendous amount of euphoria being Laura, I enjoyed it very much. But there is nothing that was greater than the euphoria I felt when I got redeemed and restored by Christ.
In that sense, this journey you had was a spiritual one at one level, in which you came to see yourself as male again. Did you come to regret because you, as it were, had an experience of Christ that you had chosen to go down the route of becoming a woman? Or had you also psychological reasons, other psychological reasons for wanting to abandon that?
Yeah, you know, I certainly regretted it because I didn't feel like, first off, that the guy who wrote the standards of care and was my doctor did an appropriate job of, you know, pre-surgery evaluation. That's a judgment call on my part. But when I realized that 60 to 70% of people who request gender change surgery are suffering from some sort of comorbid disorder, there's a lot of people that end up regretting, and I literally get hundreds of letters from regretters, and that's why I have the website.
Just explain the term comorbid disorder. I'm not sure I quite understand what that means.
Okay, the someone who presents with gender dysphoria also may be suffering from separation anxiety or dissociative disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. So there's some other disorder that's also going along with the gender dysphoria.
So there's often some kind of a mental health issue going alongside the gender dysphoria, as far as you're concerned.
Right. And then there's some people who actually have, they actually fall in love with actually looking at themselves and how wonderful they can look. That's a fetish where they actually are attracted to themselves. So some of these, and certainly not all of the people who go through this have those, but many of them do. So that's where my once I restored my life, I wanted to begin helping people. And that's what I've been doing.
And you have dedicated yourself to that task. You say you've received many stories from other people who've had similar experience.
Absolutely.
Well, let's come back to Jenny Ann. I mean, we can talk about all this. We will do as we get into things, Jenny Ann. I'm sure you disagree with a lot of what Walt had to say there. But before we do that, the thing that really prompted today's program was this international story of Caitlyn Jenner and this operation. Well, I say operation, really, it's just Bruce has become Caitlyn in a sense. And this has been a very public thing. Lots of stuff going around about it. It's a famous person in America. I can't say I honestly had heard of Bruce Jenner or Caitlyn Jenner before the story broke myself, but a character in the Keeping Up with the Kardashians reality TV show. And what do you make of all of this? And the obviously the fact that it's put the transgender issue very much into the public eye.
I think it's a very common story in the trans community that people suppress their identity. They try very hard to fit in with the norms that society demands, based on the sex you're assigned at birth, and that it's by no means unusual for it. Eventually, it'll come out. I always say to young people who are talking about trans, don't suppress it, because it'll come out, and in the time in between, you may have damaged yourself by the stress of trying to be somebody you're not. You may have upset people. For instance, I regret that my wife and my children don't get on with me anymore, and it wasn't their fault I was transsexual. And I was actually told when I got married, don't tell your wife, it might put you off. But it won't matter, because once you are married, you're cured. And of course, that's nonsense. It's a bit like they told gay people in the 60s and the 70s, if you just have a good experience that's heterosexual, you won't be gay anymore, which we now know is total nonsense. And it was the same with trans. I think it's really good that high-profile people like Caitlyn can come out and tell their stories. I agree, too, that they have the resources to make it work perhaps better for them than the average person. But that's ever thus, isn't it? Some people have more resources than others to do the things they do. I try to use what resources I have to help the community.
There have been some obviously fairly strong responses against it as well. Matt Walsh writing at The Blaze in an article titled "Calling Bruce Jenner a Woman is an Insult to Women," said what he most closely resembles is a mentally disordered man who's being manipulated by disingenuous liberals and self-obsessed gay activists. Far from having the appearance of a genuine woman, he reminds me of someone who's being abandoned to his delusions by a culture of narcissistic imbeciles. I mean, what do you say to that kind of a response?
I think that's a total misunderstanding of what it is to be trans. Medical science has showed us that the body and the brain are separately gendered during the development of the fetus, and sometimes they're at dissonance. Most of the time, people's inner gender identity exactly matches their body sex, and they don't have a problem. And it really is very hard for people who are not trans to understand trans.
Well, let's get that from Walt. Walt, do you have any sympathy with the way Matt Walsh put his criticism?
Well, he probably looked at the World Health Organization, who says that transsexuals are identified as a mental disorder. So there's information out there that suggests that it is. And the research that I've been doing over the last several years, while they can't study every transgender person, the ones they did said that there's no evidence that there is any difference between a trans person and a heterosexual person in the research I have on my blog. But my concern for Jenner is actually the fact that on two occasions he's already talked about suicide as a result of some of the surgeries that he's had to transition to a woman. One night he was up all night and was contemplating suicide. And this is one of the things in the trans community that are, it's a very troubling thing, because in the U.S., the trans community has done a survey, and people who identify as trans and who have made the transition, 41% of them have attempted suicide. So many of them are still struggling with depression and anxiety and certainly social issues, and many of them struggle with adaptation to their new gender role. So there's still a lot of problems when you have a community of people with such extraordinary high rates of attempted suicide. There's still a lot of problems that exist in the community, and it would appear as though there's much work to be done to help
these people. We'll get Jenny Ann to respond to that in a moment. But what about Jenny Ann's point that she believes there is research that shows in fetal development the gender of the brain, as it were, can be mismatched with the gender of the body?
Yeah, I've seen some of that research, but I've also seen the other research. And so there's conflicting research. And the research I've seen that she talks about was what they refer to as a hypothesis. And so the research that I have is objective research. So, you know, the research people are going to argue about all kinds of things, global warming included. So these things, the beat always goes on between the researchers.
Coming to this issue of whether surgery actually helps people generally, obviously in your case, Jenny Ann, you say absolutely it has made a world of difference. Now, what about Walt's statistic here of the percentage of people who still attempt suicide having had a sex change operation or genital change operation?
Okay, I'd like to look at some of the points and come to that. Firstly, ICD-10, the World Health Compendium of Diseases, is about to go to edition 11, where gender dysphoria is taken out of the mental health area and is put into an area of conditions that just need help, rather like birth defects, for instance. So I dispute the gender dysphoria, certainly in the UK and in a lot of other places around the world, is no longer recognized as a mental disorder, in just the same way that homosexuality was taken out of DSM-3, I think it was, and certainly the American manual, DSM-5, has taken gender dysphoria out of the mental health area. So that's something that's going on. Yes, the suicide rates of trans people are grossly above the rest of the population until they get treatment. And the statistics show us, and I can go into any number of surveys, that once people start to get help with their gender dysphoria, the suicide rates go down. They go up again when their treatments are blocked. Also, the brain patterns that we were talking about have been shown by more than one set of researchers. I think perhaps Walt needs to catch up with current research, because now the latest scanners can actually scan that difference in a live person rather than having to look at it in an autopsy after people have died, which, of course, limits the number of subjects. A UK survey showed that over 95% of people who had gender reconstruction surgery were either satisfied or extremely satisfied with their health and the way they felt after surgery. And I agree there are regretters, but we're pretty sure they're about 5%. Right. And if you look at all sorts of surgeries, for instance, prostate cancer surgery, 25% of the people who have that surgery are dissatisfied and wish they hadn't had it.
Well,
so
let's
always get regretted.
Yeah. Walt, what's your response to this? So from what Jenny Ann is saying, actually suicide rates go down on average once treatment has been applied.
Well, a Swedish study of 324 transgenders, they keep records of all of the people because it's paid for by the government there, the health agency government, and their study shows that it doesn't go down.
Well, I'm going
Hang on, can you just let me finish? Okay.
Yeah, well, you're misrepresenting the survey.
No, you're misrepresenting.
Let's allow Walt to finish his point, okay. And then you can counter it, Jenny Ann.
Sure.
Well, this is the problem. One of the things is that there's always one study that shows one thing that's used, and another study that shows another that's used. So, I think for the purposes of this conversation, all we need to do is understand that in the United States, the reason, I don't know the World Health Organization, but the reason that it was taken out as a disorder out of the DSM-5 is because of political reasons, not because of medical reasons. So it's been, the LGBT is a very powerful political force. So here it's strictly a political issue. And so we're not, as soon as the people get treatment, they are, at first, there is good success. However, as time goes on, the success rate actually goes down over a period of years, and people become dissatisfied with it. So there's still going to be a lot of conflicting research. I'm not going to try to disparage what she's saying, but by the same token, I think we need to agree that there are certainly objective studies on both sides that are conflicting, and people need to weigh that for what it's worth. Anytime there's a high suicide attempt rate like there is, it should be pretty obvious to anyone that there is still serious problems.
Well, we're discussing the issue of transgenderism today on the program. Caitlin Jenner and the transgender debate. My guests today, Jenny Ann Bishop and Walt Heyer. You can continue to listen in just a moment's time. If you want to get in touch about anything you've heard on the program today, however, I encourage you to do that via email. unbelievable@premier.org.uk is where to send your thoughts. You can also, of course, find us online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Leave a comment underneath today's program, pass it on to a friend, or get in touch via the Facebook and Twitter accounts as well. We'll be back in a moment's time as we continue today's discussion.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, Carrie Lloyd undertakes an online dating experiment. What could go wrong in her search for a Christian Mr. Right? Jamie Cutteridge opens up the debate on language as he asks, is swearing always a sin? Plus, there's loads to inspire your spiritual life, including former property tycoon Manoj Raitata's story, from filthy rich to heavenly wealth. Plus, news, reviews, and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme here on Unbelievable. We're discussing Caitlin Jenner and transgenderism. And again, just a warning to anyone listening this Saturday afternoon, today's show may contain some sensitive subject matter. Please be aware of that if you have any concerns for the age appropriateness for anybody listening in the vicinity. We're talking about this because recently the story of Caitlin Jenner went around the world. Bruce Jenner was a well-known athlete in the USA and also a personality in the Keeping Up with the Kardashians reality TV show. However, he recently underwent a sex change operation, which was revealed in a glamorous photo shoot on the cover of Vanity Fair in June. Well, to discuss that, Jenny Ann Bishop, transgender woman, and Walt Heyer, former transgender woman, reverted to being man. He bitterly regretted doing that. They're both Christians, and they're both here to debate the issues around this. We've talked already about the cultural, psychological implications of transgenderism. We'll also get on to talking about the theological aspect of this, whether the Bible says anything to this particular issue. I'm also looking forward to hearing your thoughts on today's debate. Coming back to you then, Jenny Ann, we were hearing Walt say there that he thinks that in the end there's still a strong correlation between gender dysphoria and the treatment and so on and suicide rates. I mean, in the end, he says as well in his published work, Walt, that it doesn't in the end change your gender as well, of course. You know, your DNA can't be changed in that sense. So in the end, he feels that it's a sticking plaster on a what is ultimately more of a psychological problem that needs addressing.
Okay, let me just address firstly the survey Walt was talking about. If you read the whole survey, it says a lot of the people to be followed up dropped out simply because they were getting on with their lives and that the results were inconclusive. There was another survey done in the UK which gave a 95% satisfaction rate. Now, in terms of, I agree, you cannot ultimately change the phenotype or the main sex parts of the body. I can't change my frame. I can't get narrower shoulders. I can only change my voice to a certain extent. But it's not about changing your gender. You know what your gender is. If you feel you're in the wrong gender after you've transitioned, then that was always your gender. I know now I'm in exactly the right gender. My gender has always been female, and as far as I'm concerned, it always
will
be.
Do you think that the options for having treatment to change gender should be offered to young children? I mean, prepubescent children who think that they're experiencing some kind of gender dysphoria?
Yes, I think it's very important to give them puberty blocking. Now, there's been some good work done in the Netherlands, in Germany, and in the US where puberty blocking has been given to children because in most countries they're not allowed cross hormones, that's the opposite gender hormones, until they're 16. And they, in most countries, can't have surgery, genital reconstruction surgery, until they're 18. And what the study showed was about a third of the children said it after they'd had that period of grace, and it's been shown that puberty blocking does not have any effects that are poor, because they've shown that there's no loss in bone density, no loss in fertility, no loss in height if you take the children off. Now, about a third of the kids said, no, I'm quite happy, I'm going to go back to my birth gender. A third of them said, we've confused sexual orientation and gender and decided they were gay or lesbian. But a third of the children said, no, I'm absolutely right, I need to change my gender. And by giving the children that space, you take away all the suffering of going through the wrong gender. And that's the time when young kids self-harm, maybe even attempt suicide, or their parents find them trying to disfigure their bodies because they so dislike the way they are and they need to, in their minds, to be the people they really are.
Well, I'd like to come back to Walt to talk about how we address those issues, if he is against the idea of gender change, what we do with those who obviously do find themselves in that position of resorting to self-harm. But Walt, before we do that, I know you've written recently yourself on the trend towards younger and younger children being given the option for gender change. And what's your take on that? Do you think children are in a position to be able to make that kind of decision at that kind of age?
Well, I don't. I think, there's a lot of evidence that shows that children, until such time as they're 18 years of age, I don't think have the ability to understand the consequences of their decisions. And I wrote that in my book, Paper Genders, which has been reprinted and republished in Italy and other places and used by doctors and psychiatrists there. So I think engaging in blocking medication is, in my opinion, child abuse and should not be done. But I also, I think what we're doing is that we found studies that show that if we just leave the children alone, kids are going to be curious about gender. I think that's quite normal. Probably 100% of children are going to be curious about gender and what it's about and what's a man and woman as they grow up at a young age. But what we found out is if we do not encourage them toward a gender change, that up to 94% of them would not opt to have a gender change, and that the balance of those are probably homosexual individuals. So I think so. The studies, I'm just reading from studies. I don't make the stuff up. So the studies are what that I draw from, and they're on my blog. So while it's okay to disagree with me, they're not my opinions.
Yeah, but there are other studies that are in direct dissonance with what you're talking about, Ward. And what are you going to do about kids who say to their mum, I'm going to cut my penis off if you don't help me with this? What do you do about the kids who are thinking about suicide? Are you going to let them do that? Because in the end, most of them find the peace they need by having that breathing space. And I agree with you. Children can't make those decisions about permanently changing their body until they're guillot competent. That's why they can't have hormones till they're 16 or surgery till they're 18. And I absolutely agree with that. But I really think you have to think about the maxim, do no harm. Help these children to get through their lives.
Well, what we know is that some of these young people who are talking about cutting off body parts and stuff, they are suffering from a psychological or psychiatric disorder. Someone with a healthy psychological mind would not be considering cutting any body parts off. And cutting, you know, is well known to be associated with dissociative disorders and psychiatric disorders. So instead of helping them just because they're talking about cutting their penis off, change genders, I think we need to understand that there's some deep psychotherapy that needs to discover what kind of disorder they have so that we can find out why they don't want to be who they are so they can become someone who they're not. So I think that, you know, we got to be very careful about engaging in therapies on young people when we're really experimenting with them like they're laboratory rat.
As I understand it as well, Walt, your big issue is that even by introducing lots of options and saying you've got to explore this and explore that, it opens a pathway which naturally will lead young people to consider changing their gender, when if you left things to their own devices, if you like, most of them would grow out of that desire.
That's right. I would not be a transgender today if it wasn't for my early childhood and being assisted and helped and guided by my grandmother for 2.5 years.
In as much as she was an influence towards persuading you to become a woman.
Right. I think when you plant that seed about your somebody else, whether you've done it yourself or whether somebody else encourages you and you become gender confused, you obviously have gender dysphoria at a very young age. But what we need to understand is these are psychological, psychiatric, and other issues that need to be explored. We don't need to be changing everybody's gender just because they have a psychological or psychiatric issue or a fetish or a phobia.
Jenny Ann?
No, we're not doing that. Well, for young children, we're just putting their puberty on hold so that they can be helped to understand. I mean, what about people like myself who was desperately worked on not to change my gender? I was completely discouraged by my parents, by the medical profession, by my church, by my employers. But I still knew in my head exactly who I was. And it's been shown that the majority, something like 60, 70% of trans people, will tell you they knew that their gender was not correct from the age of 3 or 4. You said yourself you thought that.
Quick response, Walt, and we'll move the subject on. I would like to talk about what the Bible has to say on this as well.
Yes, I was totally convinced beyond the shadow of a doubt that I was a female and that's what I needed to do, and I did it, and I enjoyed it. And I was happy that I was. I was successfully working, had a great job, had a great career. However, I realized there was something deeper going on. And when I explored that there was something deeper, I had a church that accepted me. I mean, I went to church as Laura. Everybody loved me there. I didn't have any problems that way. So I just have found too many people like me over the years. I thought I was the only one this way until I had my website, which now in the last 30 days has gotten over 83,000 people have come to the website, and I've gotten people calling me who are struggling and wishing they hadn't changed genders. And so there's a lot of people out there that were either misdiagnosed or mistreated, and people are suicidal. So, you know, there's two sides to this coin, and I'm very tickled that Jenny Ann has had a great success, but there's also a lot of people who are suffering and still want to commit suicide. I've had them actually contact me and say, I'm on my way down to the store to buy a gun to blow my brains out. Can you help me? I mean, they're desperate people who, and this individual had gone through the complete surgery and was successful. It was an airline pilot. And so there's a lot of stories that are not so good. And so doing this to young children, I think, is quite dangerous.
Just a reminder that my guests today on Unbelievable are Jenny Ann Bishop and Walt Heyer, the first, a transgender woman who holds positions in a number of trans networks, and Walt, who was a woman but transitioned back to being a man, having undergone a sex change operation. So two very different perspectives join me here on the show that aims to get you thinking. You can find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's talk about what the Bible does or doesn't say about the issue of transgenderism. And, well, one thing the Bible does say, and I wonder what your response is to this yourself, Jenny Ann, is that God created them male and female. He created them right there in Genesis. And many people would say your gender identity is sealed from the moment of conception, effectively. And that's the way it is in Scripture. We very much are created male or female. We can't sort of simply choose to swap genders as we go along. What's your response to that yourself as a Christian?
Okay, I think two things. Firstly, gender and physical sex are two completely different things. And one could also say, as it was famously quoted, man and woman maketh me, and I am definitely not the gender identity that my sex was identified at birth. And also remember, there are a whole range of people between male and female who have all sorts of pheno or body types, some of whom are intersex. And indeed, some of the medical profession says that gender dysphoria is just another form of intersex. You know, for instance, everybody knows XX woman, XY man, but there are lots of XY women and XX men.
Sure, and I guess intersex,
it's not an intersex simple.
An intersex condition is a kind of, I suppose, a slightly separate issue, but related, obviously. But yes. From your perspective, you don't think the Bible itself or Christians are in any under any obligation to see themselves as distinctly either male or female from birth in that sense?
Well, I think, for a start, very often the Bible is subject to interpretation. It's been translated and altered that many times. It's a good pointer, but I wouldn't take it as fact. For instance, in the Bible, woman comes out of man, whereas we know biologically that's incorrect. Man comes out of woman.
Let's get Walt's position on this. Walt, were you convicted in any way in your journey by a traditional biblical stance on this?
Well, you know, I struggled with what the Bible had to say and about my gender identity for a long time. And I wasn't so much convicted by it as I was trying to discover what, you know, coming into a relationship with Jesus Christ meant for me in my life. And that, to me, was significant, because I know that if I take the issues that I'm struggling with and lay them before the Lord and pray about them, that He says He will redeem and restore me for all that has been broken in my life. So I had been praying for many years, and it was during that prayer where I visually saw the Lord come to me. I saw myself as a new baby, a child, and He put His arms around me and picked me up and told me, you will be safe with me forever. And then that was the point at which I was redeemed and restored. So while there's nothing written biblically about that in the Bible, certainly that was a profound moment of redemption and restoration. And I was restored to my birth gender at that moment. So,
and in that sense, you had a transformative experience that for you obviously meant that your feeling of identifying as a woman changed
right.
to identifying as a man again.
Right. And I kept praying and admitting that during for a long time, I admitted, you know, what I had done was wrong. And that I regretted having done it. So I was opened myself up to the Lord redeeming and restoring my gender. Now, if he never came to me, then, you know, I would have remained Laura. But he did come to me and redeemed and restored me. So I think in my case, being open to the Lord coming to me and being open to the fact that it was a mistake to try to change my gender, no matter how strongly I felt about it, and no matter how much my feelings were about that I was someone else, I was not. You know, the reality is feelings are feelings, and feelings change, and feelings, while they feel real, aren't always reality. So in my case, the biblical part of it was just going into a deep personal relationship with Jesus Christ and him coming to me and showing me who I was.
And I've heard, Jenny Ann, a similar argument in a sense from those who say even if someone is homosexually attracted, has same-sex attraction, acting on those feelings isn't necessarily the right thing to do, even though that may bear a certain cost, and they might say the same thing about someone who has transgender feelings.
I can equally relate that over time, going to the church I go to, I came to an understanding through prayer and reading the scriptures that God was saying to me, be yourself. There are several passages in the Testament. For instance, there is a passage that says some people are born eunuchs, some are made eunuchs, and some make themselves eunuchs, and all are welcome in the kingdom. And similarly, at one point, Jesus saw a temple devoted to one of the fertility goddesses, perhaps Astarte, and he says to the disciples, see that what these people do for their God, what would you do for the kingdom of heaven? And remember, too, he sent Andrew to go and convert the eunuch. He didn't tell him you must stop being a eunuch.
And
he
when you
showed
what,
the
what's
scriptures
the significance,
and baptized him.
What's the significance for you of the role of the eunuch in that society then? Do you think they're a stand-in at some level for someone who has a different kind of sexuality?
In a way, it's a bit like being trans, isn't it? Going
someone
male
who's,
to female.
Yes. I mean, at the same time, I can imagine, I've also heard others on the conservative side, Jenny Ann, say that's a metaphor actually for someone who, you know, those who make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom could be seen as someone who denies acting on, say, their homosexual inclinations for the sake of the kingdom. They are bearing the cost. They are making themselves. So it can be interpreted in different directions, can't it?
It can. It's as I said, the scriptures can be interpreted in many, many ways. It's like the passage that talks about men and women mustn't dress as each other. And then later on, if you read the rabbinic law, it says men and women may cross-dress at festival time. Hmm. And the ban was to stop the men going to the women's camp and the women going to the men's camp when they were trying to fight a war.
Do you think, Walt, that the Bible forbids cross-dressing?
Well, I think everybody, you know, has a sin nature. And everybody does things that is sinful. And so, and that includes absolutely every last single person. I think for each individual, they'll come to their relationship with Christ in a way that they feel that Christ has come to them. And so for some people, we'll feel that way. What I do know is that the period of redemption takes a long time. I mean, in my case, it took, nearly 50 years. So I don't think we can point to any one thing and say people should or shouldn't do. I think Christ reveals himself in their life and convicts them of what they're doing at some point. And they may be living in sin and enjoying it. And at some point in time, he may reveal himself and convict them, and they'll repent.
What do you say, though, to the problem here, Walt, which Jenny Ann has brought up earlier on in the show, that what do you do with the young teenager, for instance? And there have been some tragic stories young people who have killed themselves because they haven't felt able to express a different gender identity and so on. What do you say to the Christian parent who's wondering what to do at that point, perhaps who shares your more conservative view on this, but is seeing the possibility that their child is perhaps self-harming, it's having a psychological effect, and they see that maybe allowing them to go ahead and have some kind of a change would make a difference?
Well, if a child is self-harming himself, he is suffering from a psychiatric disorder that requires real effective therapy. Now, they're obviously suffering from depression and other things, and I know of these kind of cases. And if they get proper treatment to help them with their depression so that they're not cutting themselves or wanting to do self-harm or do high-risk behaviors, if we can get them to a point to where we can sit them down in a good psychiatric environment and treat them, we can prevent their suicide. The problems, the ones that I'm familiar with where they have committed suicide, the parents have made, in my view, serious mistakes about how they provided access to treatment for the individual, or the individual didn't get good psychotherapy. And that is a problem in the community. There's very little quality psychotherapy, and so we have people who remain suffering even after they've made a gender change or when they're in the middle of it.
Presumably, you're not in favor of what Jenny Ann says her experience was of effectively suppression of these feelings and being told, look, just don't think about it, you'll get over it kind of thing.
I don't think it's a matter of suppressing feelings. I think it's a matter of identifying how the feelings started, when they started for these people who are injuring themselves, what caused them to want to hurt themselves. That's what I want to know. So I think too often we see these things always as a transgender issue when in fact it's some other issue that replicates a transgender issue, so they don't end up getting the treatment that they need.
What's your response to that, Jenny Ann?
I think that, yes, of course there are cases where it's got nothing to do with gender dysphoria, but lots of the young people I have to deal with regularly and try and help, they are self-harming or thinking of suicide because they don't feel they've been accepted as the people they are. They're not depressed in terms of depression. They're depressed because society doesn't let them at least explore who they are. Surely the least we can do for young people is to say, have the freedom to explore. If it really isn't gender dysphoria, they'll soon find out that the other gender isn't the right answer.
Well, do you think there's any kind of degree to which a Christian family or church should and could allow someone to express that? For instance, you don't believe that sex change operations have the right effect, but do you object to people cross-dressing, for instance, if they felt that was somehow an outlet and allowed them to express that side of themselves?
I will always go back to wanting to know where the feelings came from. I want to know how they got started.
Do you always think then that there's always a different, it's never gender dysphoria in the end? It's actually is always a different psychological issue?
No, I think it's gender dysphoria. I just think there's a secondary disorder that's triggered the gender dysphoria. So I think it isn't, I think they all have gender dysphoria that are struggling with it. I think what we need to find out is, are they suffering from schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety, separation anxiety, narcissism. There are so many things that need to be explored in their life to identify what the trigger mechanism. That's what I'm interested in. I'm not interested in them.
But in that sense, you would say that there always is a different trigger mechanism to gender dysphoria. That it's never something that simply stands alone and is best treated in that sense by allowing a change.
Something has caused them to not want to be who they are so that they can explore about being someone who they are not.
Quick response, Jenny Ann, as we start to close things up.
Yes, I fundamentally disagree with that. I think the reason why they feel they have a different gender identity is because of what has happened during gestation of the fetus, and they have simply been gendered different to their phenotype, to the way their body is. I and many other people who go through this treatment in the UK have to see two psychiatrists to get started. You have 2 years of psychiatric assessment, and then you need 2 more psychiatrists to investigate you before you can be put forward for genital reconstruction surgery. And surely, if the medical people can't find out in all that time what's wrong with us, if it isn't purely we're in the wrong gender, then how are we ever going to find out?
Well, I have 2 stories on my website, both from the UK, and one of them wants to revert back after 8 years to their male gender, and they want the government to pay for it. And the other one was a young child that got all that therapy that attempted suicide or wanted to commit suicide. So no matter how good the therapy is, they're still not doing a good job at long-range help for these people.
Well, you're listening to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, talking about the transgender debate. And my guests, Jenny Ann and Walt Heyer, will be wrapping up their thoughts in a moment's time in the final part of the show. And we'll be hearing a bit of your feedback too. Welcome back to the third and final part of this Saturday's Unbelievable as part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Brierley, as ever, your host, bringing 2 very different perspectives together in dialogue and debate. And we'll be finishing the thoughts of Jenny Ann Bishop and Walt Heyer on the issue of the transgender debate in a moment's time. We've got some of your thoughts in regard to recent shows soon as well. Had some interesting shows recently on archaeology, science and faith, and lots of other stuff. So look out for some of that a little later on in today's programme. If you're staying around here on Premier Christian Radio, between 4 and 5, Ben Cantillon is the subject of the profile interview. He'll be talking about his life, work, faith, his ministry as a worship leader for the Soul Survivor Network. This show, of course, and all the shows here on a Saturday afternoon, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you're not a subscriber and you live in the UK, you can ask for a free sample copy. I edit the magazine. I'm really proud of what we do month by month in the magazine, and I hope you'll be interested by some of the features, news, reviews, interviews that we feature on a regular basis. The July edition is out already, so you can read some of the interesting articles in there, including a special article by Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, on evangelism, the art of evangelism, looking at the picture by a classic picture by Caravaggio, The Calling of St. Matthew. So if you're interested in that, then why not go online and ask for a copy of the magazine, because it really does look best in print, in my humble opinion. PremierChristianity.com/free sample is the place to go if you're interested in reading that and indeed all the other great stuff that we've got in the latest magazine. Okay, advert over. Time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've had a really interesting back and forth today, Jenny Ann and Walt. So, Jenny Ann, any final thoughts as we just close out today's show?
Yes, I think it's a question of just letting people be themselves. Not everybody by any means, more probably than 80% of people who transition don't have surgery, so they could easily revert. And you know, the majority don't, because they're quite happy being who they are.
Thank you very much for being with us on the programme today, Jenny Ann. If you want to find out more about the church that Jenny Ann is part of, why not visit metropolitanchurch.org.uk, and she runs the trans ministry at Metropolitan Church Manchester. Jenny Ann Bishop, thank you for joining us. Walt, any final
thank
words
you.
as we close out today's show?
Yes, I think we also need to let people be who they are and not introduce some other gender that's who they're not.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. If you want to find out more about Walt's, Walt's work and his writing, then the place to go is sexchangeregret.com. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, and all the very best, Walt and Jenny Ann.
Thank you. Take care now.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, one more time, if you'd like to get in touch about anything you hear on the programme today, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is the place to go to leave a comment underneath the latest show, to subscribe to the podcast and find your way to all the other resources that Unbelievable offers. If you want to send me your email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I've got some Facebook and Twitter bits and pieces as well to read out as we look at some of your responses to recent programmes. So let's go to some of what's been coming in. And here's someone who says, hi, this is for Justin at Unbelievable. This came to me by a different route. And you say, my name is Amy, and my boyfriend Daniel is a huge fan of the radio show. He listens to it at work every day. He's a painter and sends me your stuff daily. I'm sorry about that, Amy. This is very random, but Daniel's birthday is June the 8th, and I'm compiling a video of many people in his life saying hi and happy birthday to him. Would you be willing to send me a video message? Well, as you can tell from the date this program is airing, I managed to completely not do that in time for Daniel. So my apologies both to you, Amy, and to Daniel for not doing that. But I hope that a little mention here on the show still gets to Daniel's ears as he's painting. And I really am encouraged that you say you're definitely in his life and his young faith has really been strengthened by your teachings. Well, it's not my teachings. I'm just the facilitator of other people's perspectives. But great to know that you're listening as you do your day job, Daniel, and all the very best to you, and happy birthday, of course. Let's go to another one here. Thomas says, I'm a regular listener to Unbelievable and have thought of a show idea I don't think you've covered. I think, if it were possible, it would be interesting to find Christians, atheists and agnostics who have changed their position, i.e. become a believer or an unbeliever, because of listening to the various Unbelievable programmes. Has anyone listening switched sides? Of course, a great show would be with a guest who went from atheist to believer and one who went from belief to agnosticism or atheism. Anyway, just an idea. Thanks, says Thomas. Well, certainly, that's a very interesting idea. In large part, those who I have heard who have gone in one direction or the other, when it comes to what influence the show has had, that's been part of certainly a bigger picture and a number of influences. I wouldn't say this show alone has ever been the deciding factor in anyone's journey. But I do get emails from people who do go in both directions, in a sense. And for some people, the evidence they hear on the show in favour of Christianity seems enough to help them, propel them on their journey towards faith, towards belief. For others, they seem to find a stronger sort of evidence in the other direction when they listen to the programme. And they say it overall consolidates their view on atheism and so on. So it really is a mixed bag. But perhaps if you're listening, and you can certainly put yourself in one of those two camps, someone who's changed, gone in one direction or the other in the time that you've been listening to this programme, I'd certainly be interested in hearing from you. And who knows, perhaps we could do what Thomas suggests there on his email. So why not email in if that's you, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Keenan gets in touch via Facebook and says, Justin, I've been a listener off and on for a couple of years now. Absolutely love the fine programming you have. I find myself wishing some of the conversations went longer. With all of this, I thought of an interesting conversation I'd be interested in hearing from a traditional Muslim discussing the source of authority in Islam with what I've seen being called as a Quranist or Quran-only Muslim. I've only just recently begun learning of this belief that the Quran is the only source of authority and that the hadiths should be rejected. I think a conversation between the two, a Quranist versus a traditional Muslim, would be a fascinating subject. I'd think a lot of your listeners would be interested in it because I don't believe many people know about the Quran-only movement. It might be just as interesting as a Catholic discussing sola scriptura with a Protestant, though in the religion of Islam. It's an interesting dynamic. Thank you very much for that suggestion, Keenan. And that's exactly the equivalent analogy I thought of in the Christian world. Someone who believes in the Bible only as a source of of authority, sola scriptura, and someone like a Catholic who believes in church authority and tradition and so on as well. I hadn't even really heard of that movement within Islam, but thank you for bringing it to my attention. Thanks also to a couple of people who've been in touch saying, what about doing a show on oneness Pentecostalism? I'm in talk, seeing if we can set something up on that in the not-too-distant future. Let's go to last week's programme, and that was a bit different. We were doing historical archaeology, does it support the New Testament and so on. We had two people join me who were both experts in their field, Sheha Shiloh and Byron McCain. And now one or two of you are posting underneath that show from last week on the Premier Christian Radio website said it was a shame there wasn't more of a sceptical perspective involved. Someone who goes by the name Abandon Window said, turned it off after the grown-up table remark. Was a boring show anyway, to be honest. Would have been nice to have a sceptic involved in the conversation. And Michael Brady chimed in on it, said yes, this episode badly needed a sceptic's voice. Now, look, in my defence here, I did try my best to get hold of a sceptic of some kind or another to kind of give a more sort of, if you like, anti-view on the programme, knowing that that would obviously be good for those who want to hear that kind of dialogue. I found it very difficult to find one, at least one that was available in the time period I needed to record. In general, I don't find that many people who have kind of a big grounding. I wasn't able to find many people with a strong grounding in archaeology, at least, who do have a particularly sceptical view of the records of the New Testament as they pertain to archaeology. But nonetheless, I tried to play a bit of devil's advocate in the programme, especially when it came to the issue of Nazareth and that kind of thing, where I think there has been the most, if you like, sceptical writing on the subject. But one or two things were picked up in the comments. Kirkatori says, Byron suggested that the lack of any roof tile fragments yet to be unearthed in the appropriate strata at Capernaum suggests that the healing of the paralytic recorded in Mark 2, where no tiles are mentioned, implies a later and perhaps derivative authorship of Luke's narrative of the event. Does this then add weight to the validity of the Q source theory? To which Michael responded, actually, he thinks it just suggests that Matthew and Luke cribbed from Mark, effectively, whether or not Q was involved. But in any case, I'm glad that at least at some level it sparked some interesting discussion among people, and we'll see what other feedback comes in as we go along on hearing more about that. Going back a bit further now to faith and science, you remember we had Eugenie Scott and Ruth Bancevich in studio with me talking about whether faith is good for science and vice versa. Here's Ray, who says, I think you might find this intriguing, even astonishing. Have you considered inviting Dr. James Tour on your show? Here's what I posted on the discussion about it. Dr. James Tour is one of the top 10 chemists in the world. Organic chemistry and nanotechnology is his field. What he says in a video is that not one single person on this whole planet, and this includes eminent chemists, notable evolutionary biologists, he names, for example, Francis Collins, Nobel Prize winning scientists, and this is precisely the circle he moves in, have been able to remotely demonstrate that evolution is possible chemically, i.e. when you consider the molecular properties, the chemical bonding properties, the processes, etc., etc. If you watch the video, you'll see that he's not been deliberately provocative. In fact, he's tried to be discreet about it. But neither is he exaggerating this claim. You'll see that not one single scientific paper can be proffered that remotely demonstrates the possibility. This is what the philosopher Etienne Bonnot de Condillac wrote. If a philosopher, deep within his study, should try to move matter, he can do it with what he wishes. Nothing resists him. This is because the imagination sees whatever it wishes to and sees nothing more. But such arbitrary hypotheses throw light on no verity. On the contrary, they retard the progress of science and become most dangerous through the errors they lead us to adopt. This isn't to say that the theory of evolution is not true, but what it does say is that when it comes to the nuts and bolts, right now, the emperor has no clothes. It is perfectly reasonable to be sceptical of this theory. Incidentally, no one's doubting microevolution here. It's macroevolution that's always being questioned. So whether you're a Christian or a secularist, you have every justification for being sceptical of the theory of evolution on good scientific ground. So that's Ray's opinion. And if you want to see the video in question, Dr. James Tour, T-O-U-R, is the person to look out for on the YouTube video that Ray references there. Sounds interesting, Ray. Here's Graham, who's a sceptic, writing in on that show, says, thanks for another interesting debate. I thought Eugenie Scott was great. I love reading and listening to Dawkins, Hitchens and Harris, but I suspect Eugenie will have more success in winning over religious people. She's just so nice, but still makes the case for non-theistic humanism powerfully. Your other guest, Ruth, was equally nice. She clearly doesn't let her religious views inform her science. As Eugenie pointed out, many religious scientists start with their beliefs and try to make the science fit, so much so that they make themselves believe that it's possible to cram every species of an animal on a boat and the world was created in 6 days a few thousand years ago. But they're also the people who believe homosexuality is an abomination and women shouldn't be in the priesthood. Science is a way of knowing, a way of testing what is right and wrong. But unlike Eugenie, I also think the process can be applied to ethics and the way we live. If you start from the premise that the object of life is human well-being, justice and empathy, then I think you can rationally decide what actions promote those things. Finally, I liked Eugenie's statement that even though the universe is pointless, her life is not. Perfectly sums up my take on life. Well, Graham, this idea that you could use science to test what is right and wrong obviously entirely depends on that first premise that you say you would have to adopt about the object of life being human well-being, justice and empathy. Of course, that's a massive assumption to make, and it's people, you know, Sam Harris wrote a whole book that effectively made that assumption at the very beginning, and was, I think, rightly criticised for not actually, if you like, giving any justification for what is, at the end of the day, a big assumption. So I think that's the whole point, is that what science doesn't give us the ought when it comes to human well-being being the overall arbiter of morality. In any case, thank you for your thoughts as well on that programme. David Howell says, I have a PhD in biomedical science with a focus on cellular and molecular medicine. Everything about the complexity of the cell and the amazing language of DNA tells me that macroevolution is impossible. However, one area the science that has me stumped is the age of the universe. How about an episode with physicist Gerald Schroeder on the age of the universe? It'd be great to see what Hugh Ross or maybe a secular physicist thinks about his theory. I've really enjoyed the broad range of topics on your show and the examination of different areas of science. So I'm assuming Gerald Schroeder takes a young Earth view on the age of the universe, for that to be the people you'd suggest him having a debate with. But in any case, thank you very much again for that. And here's another creation view, this time from someone who goes by the name Rivers in New York. I recently listened to the programme with John Walton and Stephen Lloyd regarding the Adam and Eve story. The interviewer requested some feedback about other views. Well, I've done extensive research into the text of the biblical creation story and think there's a more coherent and plausible explanation of that story that's entirely based upon a literalistic reading of the Hebrew and English text and upholds the integrity of God's inspired word and eliminates the supposed conflict between science and the Bible. The view might be called local creation in the sense that it proposes and seeks to demonstrate exegetically that the Bible creation story pertained to events that took place in a specific region of the ancient world in about 6000 BC. This perspective allows for the Earth and the universe itself to be much older and yet preserves a young creation account. If you're interested in a presentation or dialogue about this view, please let me know. Thank you very much, Rivers. I would be interested to know about that, so I'll try and get back to you on your email. There are obviously various different views that have been adopted to reconcile effectively a young telling of that story with an old Earth, and there are others I know who talk about the idea of the Garden of Eden being, if you like, something God creates within the already created world, which is much older, but as it were, for a place for him to have a special relationship with the two, you know, people that he puts his spirit into, Adam and Eve and so on. And that, if you like, that is physically was physically located somewhere. And even that the tree of life, which they're told to eat from, is what gives them their immortality until they're banished from the garden and therefore they suffer the effects of natural decay and everything else. So there are some interesting theories out there, and I wonder whether yours sort of goes along those lines. But anyway, here's again another show on Islam. We did a couple of those a couple of months ago now, and still got some of your responses coming into that. Nigel Holmes talking about David Garrison talking to two Muslims about whether Muslims are turning to Christ around the world in large numbers, says the show was a breath of fresh air. You and Mr. Garrison did as much as could have been done to ensure honesty on the part of the two Muslims who spoke on the programme. They were clearly affected by the approach you both took and by the clear evidence presented to them. Mr. Garrison was outstanding. And another one here from Richard Watson said that we heard that those said to convert were largely not true Muslims, even though they could recite the Quran and in some cases were imams. This is a classic argument that everyone who does what they do not like never was part of their group by their own definition. But it's an argument that doesn't hold a drop of water. We heard that Muslims don't ostracise or kill apostates. Well, that happens daily around the world, though unfortunately in the UK they usually just stop speaking to them and throw them out of the family and community. We heard that Muslims respect and revere Jesus, but ignored that mass murder of Christians for their faith in the name of Islam is committed on a regular basis, and many Islamic countries ban Bibles, the history and teachings of Jesus that they claim to revere, and ban the practice of Christianity. We heard that the book was to give succour to those who invest in foreign aid that's tied to some loose form of evangelism, and ignored that Islamic aid is given out only to Muslims and those who convert, even if they're dying. But what was the most interesting was the background that these two Muslims did actually appear to be able to think slightly outside the box, as most Muslim guests would have been unable to do, who merely reiterate what they're taught by rote and will accept no examination of the fact or arguments against their perceived worldview. There is hope for them yet, says Richard. Okay, turning to some of your other suggestions for future programmes and things like that, let's go to some of those. Here's Nick Knight in New Zealand says, I wonder if this idea could be an interesting podcast for Unbelievable. A Messianic Jewish rabbi named Ishak Shapira of Avat Ami Ministries wrote an insightful book titled The Return of the Kosher Pig. In this book, he surveys all the Jewish literature in reference to a divine Messiah. Included in this work are references to God being more than a single being commonly associated with strict monotheism, based on the hermeneutical, theological, and traditional Jewish positions based within the Old Testament. And he links this with Jesus the Jew of the New Testament. He discusses, for instance, how rabbis and scholars of Judaism dealt with these issues and what their conclusions were. It could be an interesting topic where two or more Jews discuss Trinitarian ideas, for instance, from the Jewish commentaries themselves with reference to the Old Testament. Anyway, one thing I found especially interesting in this book of Exodus, when the voice of the Lord speaks and is heard by the people of Israel, the Hebrews say they heard more than one voice. And if I recall Ishtar correctly, they heard three voices speaking to them. A hint of Trinitarianism, perhaps? Thank you very much for that suggestion. Robert says, I found myself actually desiring to go to work simply to listen to your show during my 45-minute commute. I can hardly wait to go home in order to finish the rest of the programme. Thank you very much, Robert. I've noticed that there are a few debates regarding eschatology. It is my understanding that we here in the States do have a higher degree of interest and even in some cases obsession with the topic. But I do believe it's important, in particular, when one understands that scripture was written for us and not to us, it changes your perspective on current events and how they relate to the so-called end times. Preterism, or covenant/fulfilled eschatology, is a viewpoint that many immediately write off as heretical. I, however, believe that if presented accurately and without bias, many will come to understand this viewpoint as more biblical than most any other viewpoint on the subject. And like me, I believe they will have many of their questions answered. Don K. Preston and William Bell are two such individuals who'd be good to have on your show to discuss and debate the matter. Please consider bringing this topic to your programme, as I believe many will begin seeing end times in a whole new light. Well, you may be aware, Robert, if you are familiar with the full back catalogue of Unbelievable shows, that several years ago we did a show precisely on preterism, which isn't a topic isn't the terminology that tends to get used here in the UK. It's more a state thing, I think. But effectively, it's talking about, yes, whether the end times have actually been fulfilled at some level already. And I believe there's partial preterism and full preterism, and we had a partial preterist, D.D. Warren, on the show several years ago talking to people of other perspectives. Yes, maybe it's time to do that again at some point. There's lots we could do on the show. It's always hard to decide sometimes which avenues to go down Finally, just some thoughts from Tom Maher, who says, I pastor a few small Protestant churches in the Netherlands. I'm an avid listener of the show through iTunes. I studied theology in England and wrote my MA dissertation on the subject of the Bible and the environment. I might be mistaken, but I don't recall you ever doing a show on that subject. Is that a conscious choice? The question of the Bible and the environment might not be directly linked to apologetics, but it does have an impact on the way in which the Bible is viewed by those who believe and those who don't. The main questions we have to ask are, can we read the Bible from an ecological perspective? If yes, what does the Bible say about care for the environment? If not, has the Bible become obsolete? Or should we perhaps even reject parts of the Bible that don't seem to be eco-friendly? I hope you get why I think it's important to have this conversation. And you go on to suggest some British academics who might be good possible candidates for debating it: Hilary Marlowe, Jonathan Moo, Richard Borkham, and on the sceptical side, Francesca Stavrakopoulou, Edward Adams, David Horrell, and others. Well, Tom, great idea. And I think we probably are due for an environmental debate, especially with the talks coming up in Paris towards the end of this year on the environment. So, maybe we'll try and schedule something in during the autumn. Thanks for all the suggestions. I do enjoy reading through them. I don't always get a chance to read them out, but today's show just presented a bit more time to be able to share some of those. And if you're listening and you've got a suggestion, why not send it in as well? Unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
You're unbelievable.
Well, I hope you can join me again next week for Unbelievable. You'll be hearing the roundtable discussion that I hosted between Jean Vanier and a group of students. Jean Vanier won the Templeton Prize this year, and he is the founder of L'Arche, an international network of communities in which disabled people, especially people with intellectual disabilities, live alongside assistance. And it's done amazing work in breaking down some of the stigma around intellectual and learning disabilities. So you'll be hearing from him about his Christian faith and some of the interactions he had with various students studying in philosophy and theology in a special programme next week, recorded shortly after the Templeton Prize giving ceremony. So hope you can join me for that at the same time, same place next week. Coming up next, it's The Profile.
This New Year's Eve, get ready for the ultimate crossover celebration. The Liberty Church Global invites you to join us at one of our three events in either London at the O2 Intercontinental, the Grand Hotel in Birmingham, or at the Landmark Centre, Lagos, Nigeria. Join Dr. Shola Fola-Alladay and an incredible lineup of guest artists, including Sumi Sola Agbebi, Dare Justified, Prince Emmanuel, and many more. London, Birmingham, or Lagos, you're covered. Start your 2026 with a bang. Doors open at 8 p.m. in the UK and 10 p.m. in Lagos. Head to tlccrossover.com/radio now to grab your free tickets. Three cities, one unforgettable night. Register for your free tickets. tlccrossover.com/radio now.